Today is April 20th, 2007, and this is the Apple Weekly Report, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
It's been yet another oddball week, and it's not that there's no news. Final Cut Studio 2 is out. Samsung's senior vice president of marketing for the memory division pleaded guilty to price fixing this week. I seeded my lawn last weekend. There was an update to iTV. I was excited about that. That would be EYE TV, the Elgato product. They released a software update. I was psyched about that. Nice additions. Creative Suite 3 is out. You must be excited about that, Jeff.
Oh, yeah. I'm waiting with bated breath for my copy to show up. So, but in the meantime, I still have my beta, so I can play with that.
Thank the powers that be.
Yes, thank the powers that be. So now, but the price fixing story, that really hasn't had much reverberation through the industry. And since we already have talked about CS3, and I'm sure most people are really tired of hearing me go on about that. Final Cut Studio, it's out, but that's probably due for its own context machine. So looks like this is not the week to go digging into another Pro package, regardless of which one it is.
Right, a little close after that CS3, that lengthy CS3 discussion we had. So we figured we'd set aside that. But the most important thing is that all of the stuff that actually happened this week, even if we went to try and put it in context, all of it's less interesting than what we're actually going to do today, which is to run an interview that we did with a lady named Amanda Palmer, who's from a Boston-based band called the Dresden Dolls. And I figured we'll talk a little bit about, before we actually run the interview, talk a little bit about why it's on the show. We planned this interview because, you know, here at the Apple Report, we talk constantly about the music industry. Apple's really deeply involved in it. It's a big part of understanding what's going on in the consumer electronics industry and all these other things. We talk about the impact that iTunes has had and that it might have in the future. You hear Brian comes on the show and rants about how artists are getting pinched by the big labels. And Jeff, you've said that iTunes is changing the way artists do record sales and everyone's doing record sales. You know, we geeks talk about this stuff like we know about it. But, you know, we realize what do we actually know? How involved are we in this industry? So we figured we might as well go out and get an actual musician here on the show to pick through some of the details with us and get it straight from, as they say, the horse's mouth, to really put the perspective of the artist in context. And I think it'll become a very useful thing in retrospect as we continue to talk about the music industry in future shows. So we're going to get right into that interview. It's a really interesting thing, and we'll just run that in full in just a moment. But first, there's one other sort of administrative bit we got to do here. We got to pay some bills. We got to tell you guys how to get a free audiobook. Audible.com is sponsoring the show again this week. They did that a couple weeks ago. They're doing it again. So, we're going to talk a little bit about that for a second.
That sounds good. And from what I understand, we actually had a really good response from our listeners to the Audible.com deal that we ran before, where they got a free book.
Yeah, so it's very cool that they're, you know, helping out the show, and we really appreciate that. I know, Jeff, you were saying last time we talked about this that you've used Audible.com a little bit. You want to tell people kind of about Audible and what their service is?
Sure. You know, when you go into a bookstore, you can go to the Audible book section and buy those antiquated old cassettes or CDs now with your book on them and listen to them at home, in the car, whatever. Audible.com takes care of the part where you want to get it from the CD to your computer or iPod. So they let you download the books that you want to hear right to your computer instead of having to go and get them at the store and rip them from a CD. And they have It's like over 35,000 titles to choose from, really wide range to select from, something for pretty much everyone, I'd say.
Yeah, so they've been in this game for a long time. They are by far the the big pop on the internet block for selling content, entertainment stuff. So definitely check it out. And if you're curious about this free audiobook, it's really cool that they do this with when they come on here as a sponsor. You go to the show notes, MacObserver.com/roundup, click on the link for this week's show, and right at the top there, the show notes for this show, you'll see a link, and you just click through that, and you can sign up right away and get a free audiobook. So that's the only way to get that thing, is to go through the show notes, it'll let them know that you came from this show, which of course helps us out, helps them out, so everybody wins, and you guys get a free audiobook, which is sweet. So that's that. Go check that out. Now, everybody, you should just sit back. Kick back, grab a glass of something that you like drinking, and take a listen to this. This is a pretty cool conversation that we had. An industry insider, she's talking about the business, the lifestyle, just the art of making music, all those things. We kind of meandered around and really had a good time talking to her. So enjoy. So we're here now with Amanda Palmer of the Dresden Dolls, which is a Boston-based band. And first of all, Amanda, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here.
Start with a little bit of background on you and the Dresden Dolls. Some of our listeners won't know about your band, so can you just kind of give everyone an orientation, the brief version of what kind of music you play, where you're coming from, what kind of stuff you do?
Sure. The band started about 6-7 years ago. I was a solo piano player and seeking a backup band, and I met this drummer, Brian, and we sort of just, met each other, had this like incredible musical chemistry, and we formed the band sort of expecting that we would expand it with other members, but we started gigging just as a piano and drums duo, and it worked so well that we just left it that way, and we've remained a two-piece ever since. And, the music is really sort of a cross between rock and punk and cabaret with a little bit of show-tuny jazz stuff to, turn in. The music's pretty emotional and personal, and but also on the other hand, it's also kind of poppy and accessible. People usually have a really hard time trying to describe it. And the live show is really where it's at, because we play and improvise off of each other. So the live shows are just very intense and fun, and our fans get very involved in dressing up the clubs and dressing up the club themselves and each other.
We should probably point out to all the listeners out there that obviously if you're in the Boston area, you can track them down up there. And I should also point out, this will be in the show notes, but the Dresden Dolls have their own website. And of course, you can find their stuff on iTunes, and we'll be talking about that in a second. But I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, so basically we've just been gigging and touring nonstop for 6-7 years. And since the band started, we started small in Boston, playing little local clubs and galleries and lofts and wherever we could get a gig. And then one thing led to another, and we got signed by a major label. Since then, we've toured the world three times. Been to Europe 10 or 12 times. We've toured the States endlessly. Basically, we've just been on the road doing shows. We've made two records that have both come out on the label. And we basically went nonstop until the fall, when we sort of slowing down to take a break, because we were just completely exhausted from traveling all the time.
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess everyone deserves a break every now and then. So the next time you're not on a break and you're in Colorado, I'll make a point to come see you.
Oh, we're going to be there in June.
In June?
We're excellent. We're playing at Red Rocks. So you got to come out. I'm so excited to play there. It's just like,
have you ever? Have you ever played it
during
the
day? Like I've hiked around on it. Like we were playing somewhere in Colorado. We stopped there just so we could see it, even though there was no show.
Playing Red Rocks is like no other venue in the world. You're going
I
to
know,
love it.
I can't wait. I can't wait. So we're doing this whole tour in June with Blondie and Cyndi Lauper and Erasure. It's like a big package tour.
Excellent. I'll be there. Okay.
Awesome.
Now, just for your info, we are a technology-related podcast and publication, so I wanted to get a couple questions in for our readers that get all excited about the tech end of things. As far as your recording setups and things like that, how sophisticated, how teched out are you for that?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, personally, Brian and I, we're not really very techie. I mean, we're about as techie as the next person who's constantly on the road and constantly connected. You know, we both spend a lot of time online. We email a lot. I email an absurd amount. I mean, I sort of, like, just for fun, checked my own traffic of sent messages, and I average about, like, 60 or 80 messages a day. I have a MySpace page. Brian has a MySpace page. And so we're very online and we're very connected, but neither of us are very tech-savvy. But what's been really lucky in the world of the band is that we've sort of surrounded ourselves with people who can be savvy for us, and we've hooked up with a posse of tapers who do come and tape our shows with great equipment and throw it up online for the band to improve, and so we've got a constant streaming output of live recordings that we just give to our fans for free. And people have set up their own websites, a couple of different websites as sort of repositories for live shows.
And so it does seem like you guys take pretty good advantage.
Any downside to that. It's been great.
It does seem like you guys take pretty good advantage of the whole kind of mobile recording, the fact that studios have essentially kind of scaled down in the last several years and made it possible to do all this stuff on the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it also is, I mean, there are different kinds of bands. Since our show is very improvised and very, you know, you never quite know what you're going to expect and how things are going to pan out, it does make it hit or miss, because if we have a bad show, it's a really bad show. But if it's a great show, it's definitely something that you want to have captured. So, in other words, we never play a show the way you hear us on the record.
You know, any show you can walk away from, that's a good show.
That's what we say, at least, doing the podcast.
No, and it's, you know, there's sort of a downside to it. I mean, one thing that people are getting really into now is the idea of doing instant live recordings and selling them at the shows. And there's always people getting in touch, you know, companies getting in touch with us to jump on that bandwagon, and I'm totally not into it. Because I just think that's like a terrible kind of pressure to put on the artist. It's like, no matter what happens, no matter what your show is like, this is going to be sold to your fans. You start thinking, well, you know, what if it's a terrible show? We're ripping people off. You know, I mean, granted, no one has to buy it, but it's, I think there's that nice sort of threshold between, you know, having the ability to do that, but also having the sort of foresight to curate it intelligently.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the recording end of things, which label are you on?
We are currently on Roadrunner Records, which is surprising to most people because their roster is mostly heavy metal. But they took an early interest in the band and have treated us pretty well, and they've really, you know, internationally, they've really put us on the map, so we have a lot to thank them for.
So one of the things we want to do here is give people a sense. We talk about the record industry and record labels and their relationships to artists on this show all the time. And a lot of the time, quite frankly, since obviously neither Jeff nor I are rock stars nor touring musicians of any kind, a lot of the stuff that ends up in the conversation when tech people talk about artists and labels is essentially hearsay, or it's vague impressions of how stuff works. Can you give us a little bit of a sense of what, I mean, to kind of zeroth order, what does a record label do for you? Why is it, for example, what's the difference between being signed up with Roadrunner and being signed up with some other record label? What is it that they do for you? What is it that they help you get done?
Well, a record label, especially nowadays, is really, in essence, a promotional tool for the artist. Promotional slash distribution tool. That's something that, you know, no matter how good your music is and no matter how industrious and motivated you are, it's very difficult to just sort of, you know, drive to a record store with a box of great CDs and put them in the hands of the clerk. You really have to go through certain channels, and the record label is that channel. And also, you know, as a touring musician, if you're showing up in Sydney, Australia for a gig, people are going to have heard about you somehow in order to, you know, be aware that tickets are on sale, that your band exists, and that your record's great.
And have a relationship with the venue and do the marketing.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to remain a local artist, you don't need a record label at all. You can basically do it all yourself. But once you can do it all yourself, you know, the record label has the relationships with radio, and they can also front you money to make promotional videos, you know, which is definitely sort of going down the drain now that it's, you know, the glory days of MTV are over. But, you know, basically they promote the band in a way that you personally just can't.
Now, one of the other things that all of the Apple Watchers out there tend to assume, and this is, again, through greater and lesser degrees of actual knowledge about what's going on. One of the things that Apple Watchers tend to assume is that the iTunes music store has a very different way of interfacing with artists and relating to that process than the existing infrastructure for selling music. The first question is that true? And if so, what are some of the differences? What are some of the differences that you experience selling your music through iTunes versus the conventional distribution channels?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing that everyone has been talking about is that it's becoming a single-driven market instead of an album-driven market. And, you know, instead of going into a store, and if you want to, you know, we had a hit song on our first record called Clean Operated Boy, which was, you know, getting video play and radio play, and it was the song people knew. If you wanted to buy the song and you were, you know, in your local indie record store, you had to buy the whole album. If you went onto iTunes, obviously you can buy just the song. And so looking at our sales from iTunes, we can see what's selling and why. But there's also something, as the artist, something depressing about that. Like, you know that, you know, that people who just heard the tune and like it and buy the single won't necessarily, especially for a band like us, because we have really different dimensions in the songwriting and the songs themselves. And that was sort of like the beauty of the album, is that you could really have this like widespread of music, and if people, you could hook people with the single to lure them into the rest of your record. On the flip side, there's something kind of beautiful about it, because if the rest of the album is crap and you don't have to deal with listening to some band's horrible filler just because you wanted one hit song, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. It really depends what kind of band you are, and it depends what kind of listener you are.
Do you go out of your way to take advantage of that? I mean, do you, when you go to create an album now, do you spend time thinking about, you know, are we going to be selling singles off this on iTunes, or are we going to be trying to sell the whole album?
I don't think about that at all. I mean, I have found that, you know, thinking about any of this stuff can just really throw you through a loop. And when I sit down to write, I just try to write good songs and assume that somehow they'll get out to people. And even in, you know, the worst case scenario, even if I am putting my music up on the internet for free, it's still going to drive my business, which is ultimately a touring business. Because when you're signed to a major label, you're seeing very, very little money from the sales of your records. You're seeing very little money from the sale of your music on iTunes or other, you know, paid download sites. So it's really just a question of, you know, point A to point B. Like, I write music, people hear music, and then I go play a show. And if the quality of your music is consistently good and people know about it for whatever reason and through whatever channels, you can have a successful career as a musician, but you do have to tour. And that's going to become more and more true as the years press on and we see the internet completely taking over.
Now, Amanda, the iTunes store, it's been around as long as the Dresden Dolls. Mm-hmm. Do you see that there's been some type of correlation between having the ability to go buy singles and improving your band's visibility?
I would have to guess, yes. I mean, that's one of those questions that's really tough to answer, because how do you know? But I think certainly the easy access to, you know, hear a song on the radio and, you know, when you get out of your car and go home, you can sort of impulsively get online and say, oh, that band I heard on the radio, the Dresden Dolls, let me just search this. Oh, yeah, that's that song I heard. Oh, I'll just buy it. I mean, that's very, very different from, you know, 1989, where it was, you know, call up the college radio station. What's the name of that band again? Where's the album? Go into your local indie record store. Do you have the Dresden Dolls record? No, but we can order it. How long is it going to take? 2 weeks. How much is it? $15. And like, now all of a sudden you've got all these heavy decisions to make. Do I want to wait 2 weeks? Do I want to pay $15? Is this album going to be worth it? You know, it's just like, it's, you know, the impulsive factor is just so high. But I also think that there's something, I've been having these long philosophical discussions about this with one of the guys who does our internet marketing. He's like a massive music freak. He's tens of thousands of songs and records. And we were talking about the difference between just having instant access impulsively to everything you hear and like versus the way it was, you know, when I was in high school, where you had CDs to just hit the market. And I had a very defined, limited record and tape collection. But there's something, you know, there was something really beautiful about, oh, you know, having this very limited choice, because you became really intimate with all of the music that you owned.
It kind of forces you to digest over time.
And there's something, you know, and now, of course, I not only have, you know, the internet like everyone else does, but, like, you know, I make enough money that I can go into a record store and buy a bunch of records and not, you know, feel a huge pinch, whereas it used to be like a real event for me to spend $8.99 on a tape. But being, you know, piled high, you know, there's music just everywhere in my apartment, and I have thousands of CDs, and I have tons of music online that people send me, and there's something really oppressive about it. Like, it's actually sort of frightening, because it's so much harder to become intimate with the music you do have when there's so much of it.
Well, having it so widely available, I would think, I mean, I kind of have this experience when I go to look for music, there's this sense that you have to digest it very quickly. Someone plays a song for you and you have to either like it or not and move on.
Right.
Whereas if you buy the album, you can play it, you live with it, you left it in your car for a while, and you know, it was playing constantly, you got it really in your brain.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, stuff really does grow on you. I mean, I can't tell you how many albums I had, you know, when I was a kid that I inherited from, you know, an older brother or, you know, whatever. And it's the sort of thing where I think if it came across my desk now, I would listen to the first few seconds of it and say, like, oh, you know, I'm not really into this and toss it. But when you've got very little choice and you're sort of forced to live with a record, it really can grow on you. And I think that's, I mean, you could extend this conversation to the entire internet in general. You know, it's sort of it's that same question of, is it really fulfilling to be in touch with 300 people in your life instead of 30 people?
is that, constant access.
I mean, where does that ultimately get you? And is the quality of the relationships actually suffering instead of improving because you spread yourself so thin? And I think you could say the same thing about all these social networking sites as you could about music. I mean, music is just, it's so impossible to explain what it is and what it's supposed to do for you and what it's supposed to give you. But having massive amounts of it isn't necessarily the answer.
That's
having
actually
massive access to it isn't necessarily the answer.
Now, that brings up a set of questions that that we wanted to ask you about. Obviously, the Dresden Dolls and you personally have spaces on MySpace. You're clearly involved in social networking. Now, if you weren't before, you're involved in podcasting. There's this concept of viral content that anyone can post up their content. That collection of technologies is stuff that at least the tech people very excitedly call Web 2.0, and we talk about it. The tech folks talk about it incessantly. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about the role it plays. Like you're saying, you're online a lot. You do have a presence in those places. What's your opinion of them generally? I mean, are they helping? Are they a problem? Is it just a thing that causes psychological distress for the reasons that you were just describing?
Sure. Well, there's a couple different answers. What's interesting is that I feel like there's two completely different sets of answers for this question. One is if I'm answering as Amanda Palmer, a human being, and the other is if I'm answering as like Amanda Palmer running the business of a band in the cutthroat music industry. And the internet has been, it's been so huge. It's been a giant factor in how our band came to be and how things have grown. And just in terms of the way our fans connect with each other and the way I connect with the fans, like I'm this very sort of let it all hang out. I blog extensively about my personal life. I keep myself very connected with the people that I see when we tour and our fans. And artistically, it's been a huge boon because our fans are, you know, they're sort of like this very, very creative and inspired bunch of people. So they make a lot of artwork and they make videos inspired by the band and they make sculptures and send us photographs. You know, there's all this stuff. There's all this product that sort of fallout from the community that's grown up around the band. And in the past, there would have been no way that they could have all shared it with each other. And now it's almost like we sort of run an online cafe museum for all our fans to kind of hang out in and look at each other's stuff and connect.
I guess to some extent, it replaces the groupies that would come on the road with you, the people that just got in their car and drove from show to show.
Yeah, exactly. It's that's incredible. And it's just magnificent to see people from, you know, Australia making art and posting it to the net, and then seeing kids from, you know, Japan and Georgia saying like, oh, I really like this, and I like what you did, you know, and I like what you did with this, and here's my art, it reminds me of that, you know, just like you're just watching this huge conversation take place, thinking like, wow, I really had nothing to do with this. I just wrote some songs and I've connected all these people. And it's really, it's an incredible feeling. And, you know, they've inspired each other to sort of like creatively wrap the band in this beautiful world of, you know, performance art and creativity that we really actively encourage people to do creative stuff at our shows. And just by virtue of the fact that they know that all these things are happening in other places because of the internet, you know, kids will come to a show and do some kind of performance art in the lobby, take photos of it, take clips of it, put them up on YouTube, and then, you know, the next day all of our fans are privy to it. So, I mean, it's been gigantic. And then there's the obvious stuff. It's like anyone who wants to hear our music can hop on our website or hop on our MySpace and check it out. And, you know, so that's the upside. The downside is, I mean, I think the downside is more on the personal level, at least for me. Certainly, I see it in a lot of our younger fans. is that you can get so into connecting on the web that you disconnect from real life. And even at our shows, I've spent a lot of time just in the past like year or two talking about this. It's like you see an entire front row of people at a show, like as soon as there's something exciting to look at or some unexpected event, people stop watching and they start archiving, you know.
Everyone pulls out the camera phones.
At that moment
that
you really
want
everyone to be paying attention, everyone is reaching down to get their camera phone.
Uh-huh.
And that creates a real kind of disturbance in the force phenomenon, because you realize, or at least my theory is, you know, and it's a simple theory, is that it's not so much that people want to record that moment. It's they want to share that recorded moment once they get home and they get online. You know, because they're not taking that picture just so they can have it. They're taking that picture because they're going to get home and they're going to throw it up on their MySpace page, or they're going to throw it in their photo bucket and network further. You know, I was there. I experienced this. It's
look
really
at me.
Cool.
I was at this concert. It was sweet. I don't remember what happened, but...
Right. So,
but at least I can go look at a picture and see.
Right, so I mean, as fantastic as YouTube is, and as fantastic as it is to have all these like great networking, video streaming, like it's just very dangerous, because I feel like people really, myself included, like you get that real itch to live in the archives moment instead of in the real moment. And that can just destroy you.
Now, I want to mix it up a little bit here and jump back over to the business end of things again and get your perspective on digital rights management. And this is something that the record labels have been really, really pushing for quite a while, saying, you know, if we don't have this, the whole music industry is going to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we're getting EMI saying, well, maybe it won't collapse. And so I just wanted a perspective on all of that.
Well, ask me a specific question. I'll see what I can do.
Okay. Do you feel like digital rights management is helping the recording industry or hampering it?
I think it's probably hampering it. I mean, you're sort of talking about like the crackdown on piracy and that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah, so this is the technology, like, for example, when you buy something from iTunes, the fact that you can't distribute it over a file-sharing network freely, the fact that it only plays on your computer.
I think that that's just probably ultimately short-sighted. I mean, it's very difficult to admit, and it's difficult to sort of grasp and come to terms with, but I feel like the entire paradigm really might just shift. Music may be free. People are just going to have to deal with that. Music is going to be promotional.
I assume that you're saying that in kind of aligning it with what you said before about how you don't make money off of selling the music, you make money off of performing.
Correct. I mean, what I've felt is at least I can speak for them like us, the fans really do actively, if they like the music and they believe in the band, they actively do want to support you. So you've got this giant network of mini patrons. And I've had, like, several times, I've had people, you know, come up to me after a show or you know, like, actively seek me out and press a $10 bill into my hand saying, like, I ripped your record from someone, but I really wanted you to have this.
Yeah.
And that's where it really turns into this kind of theoretically ethical question of, you know, can people see listening to music as a different kind of act, and can they see themselves as, you know, voluntary patrons of that music? And I've seen some artists lately doing some interesting stuff, same with photographers and stuff, saying, like, here's my stuff, I'm putting it up online, and here's my PayPal account. if you download any of this stuff, can you please contribute? And, you know, is that a great business model? No, it's a total disaster. But it's interesting to see that, you know, consumers are also human beings. If you fostered a certain kind of fan base or relationship with your fans, you know, are you going to, I mean, is it ever going to be the equivalent of going triple platinum? Like, I doubt it. I think those days are just over. Will you be able to make a living as a musician? And that's the question. And I think the answer is yes. You just have to be smart about it. And as people keep pointing out, you know, you have to really treat your audience with respect. And that's what I think one of the problems with all of this anti-piracy stuff is, it's like there's something really patronizing and disrespectful about it, you know?
It is an interesting.
People who are listening to your music, it's not, you know, it's not smart. It's not creating that kind of relationship.
I want to back up just a second. You mentioned something that I think to software folks might actually sound very familiar. You're talking about people who create music and then put it out there and then basically say, donate if you liked it. There are software people out there that probably are thinking, as you're saying, that that sounds a lot like freeware. It sounds a lot voluntary shareware. And there are a lot of people out there, you know, the Snickersware. Send me something if you like what I did.
Right.
Yeah, it's also interesting that you commented that the way it works now, it's almost like it's patronizing to the listener. And that's along the same lines as other discussions we've had here where we've talked about the way the music industry is treating their customers as if they're all criminals.
And yeah, exactly. I mean, that's just, once again, it's incredibly short-sighted. These are the people that you want to have on your side. You know, you don't want to be creating a battle.
Now, there is your audience. This deal that was announced a couple weeks ago, and I don't know if you saw this come across the news. It was a very big deal for all the Apple folks out there that watch this stuff closely. Apple and EMI announced a deal that EMI.
Yeah, I did. I did hear about that.
Yeah, and so they'll make their, for the people playing at home, will make their library available without any digital rights management. And the price is a little bit higher, the quality of the audio is a little bit higher, and then the albums, full albums themselves, will still cost $10, but they'll be available without any DRM. It sounds like this is something you'd be excited to see happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think everything is going to be either a step forward or a step sideways, but, you know, hopefully at some point. I mean, the thing that I keep trying to keep in mind is that, you know, iTunes is just, it's just easy. And for the vast majority of people, they would rather just get on iTunes, download a song for 99 cents or an album for $10 or whatever it ends up being, than spend even the extra minute and a half they might need to spend to get it through some other site or whatever it is. So, you know, it's like a lot of other things. I feel like convenience is going to rule in the end.
Well, it is. That's kind of a depressing note to end on. Convenience is going to take down all of music. I guess one of the things that I am curious about, I mean, it sounds like your kind of school of music is much more the analog, get on stage, perform, improvise. And so it's interesting to have you come on here. I've spoken to musicians who do all of their stuff digitally. They're very big on making everything in the studio, and then they replicate the studio experience on the stage. Ultimately, when you look at where music is headed, I mean, are you excited? Presumably, you're excited about the music that you create. Specifically, are you excited about the music industry at large? I mean, is it something that you're glad to be in at this time, or would you, this is kind of an odd question, rather have been in the music industry in, say, the 60s or the 30s?
I think that's impossible to answer because I think there's so many pros and cons of both. I mean, if I were writing the, you know, kind of music that I'm writing now and Brian and I had met, you know, in 1968, would we have been able to get a record deal? Like, probably not. You know, I mean, there was a much steeper pyramid scheme back then, and you know, to be signed to a record label was just a much bigger deal, I assume. And you know, musicians have become so much more self-educated and savvy about how the business works. Period. I mean, I feel like I read all of these stories about, you know, musicians getting signed and dropped and whatever in the 80s, and it's like, well, wasn't it like now? Didn't they all know? And the truth is, they didn't know. And I think a huge part of that is because they didn't have the internet, and you didn't have this just like vast open sharing of everybody's information. And the picture from, you know, from whatever your garage where your band is making your music is just so much hazier. If, you know, you're looking to sign with a major label record, with a major record label like 1981, you were just really excited that some guy was coming along saying, like, hey, I'm going to sign your band, and we're going to give you all this money. And you just, you know, musicians right now are just, generally, they're just so much more in touch with what it means and what it's all about. But, you know, there's something that music just always essentially boils down to, which, like, is it good? Is it fun to watch? Are people having a good time? And then everything else sort of falls in after that. You know, everything else falls around it. Like, the music business is kind of, it's always going to exist, but, you know, if the music comes first, then, you know, it's just something that you're always going to have to deal with in any of its incarnations. And I think a lot of it also just comes down to what kind of people you're working with. I mean, you can try and stereotype the music industry or labels or managers or promoters, but for every rule, there's a million exceptions, and often it really just comes down to who are you dealing with, and are they ethical, and do they love music, and do they love listening to music? Are they in this for the money? And for, you know, for every evil major label story you hear, and like wonderful independent record store story you hear, there's some wonderful promotions guy at a major label and some dickhead running a, you know, really terrible independent label. And it's just, you know, it's so impossible. I mean, the music industry is just so interesting to me that way, because it's just a huge mess. It's very few rules, and it, you know, basically, if you want to get in on it, you just sort of plug yourself in. You can't really go to, you know, rock school. People, like, everyone's backgrounds are just completely different and really interesting. And I'm just going off and going on a tangent.
But there was that movie with Jack Black where he had school. Yeah.
Yeah, there was.
So it sounds, I mean, at the end of the day, podcasting, Web 2.0, Napster, iTunes, they're all just technologies. Eventually, you just got to get in the dark room and write the rhymes and put down the chords.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the most beautiful thing about music, is that the fundamental one, I mean, the essential fundamental thing that I like to think makes music so essential to the fabric of, you know, our culture, any culture really, is that, you know, one person writes or plays music, another person is affected by it. Or a whole group, a gathering of people are affected by it. And then after that, there's all of this bullshit, and then there's the money that becomes involved, and how did the people get in the room, and how did they hear the music in the first place, and why are they all connected? But if you don't have that first fundamental ingredient, you know, none of this other stuff matters at all.
Well,
and all of those, you know, all of those channels and you know, the YouTubes and the Napsters and the labels and the vinyl and the, I mean, all of that's going to come and go. But nothing can replace the human connection part, which is why everyone loves it in the first place.
Well, Amanda, we do want to thank you for coming on the show anyway and helping us sort out the bullshit part of it. to give people an idea of what's going on and also keeping everybody's eye on the ball, on the stuff that's actually important. So thanks very much for coming on the show.
Oh, it was a blast.
Yeah, you added a really nice, refreshing perspective to this whole jumbled, mixed-up music industry game where everyone's somehow sucked into.
Awesome. Well, people can always see more by going to our website, YouTube channel, MySpace. I mean, we're our empire, our net empire is broad and vast. So,
and of course, we'll link to as much of that as possible in the show notes for everyone to go and check out. So, Amanda Palmer, everybody from the Dresden Dolls, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to the Apple Weekly Report.
And thanks, of course, also to Amanda for joining us. If you have questions, comments, if you have comments for her, or if you have reactions to the interview, thoughts about it, go ahead and send them to us. The email address, of course, as always, is roundup@macobserver.com. Welcome to all the folks who found us because of contacts with the Dresden Dolls. Welcome to the Roundup, and we hope to hear you here, or that you guys will come back next week and check out the show if you're interested in the geeky tech stuff that we talked about. And no matter what, the content is written by the staff of the Mac Observer when we do the news. I guess we didn't do too much of that this week. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. Pick up that free audiobook from audible.com. Thanks again to them for sponsoring the show. The show notes are at macobserver.com/roundup. Click up through to the show notes for this particular show. Enjoy that, and that is all I've got this week.
Yep, don't forget, go get your Audible book. It's free, and free is my favorite price. And stay subscribed.
Until next week, everyone, we'll see you online.